Welcome to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to have some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. For some time now, we have been studying the web of debt, which is essentially the shocking truth about our money system and how we can break free from it. Over the last several months, I've been looking at how our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been, in fact, privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing us of the value of our money. The web of debt really is a thesis that unravels the deception and presents a crystal clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are all heading. But it also explores a workable alternative, one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. What we're looking at is to find financial security, our own and our nation's and the world's, and that's what we have been dedicating this show to over the last several months in a series exploring the book, The Web of Debt. The Web of Debt is a phenomenal work written by Ellen Hodgson Brown. And I have to say at the beginning that the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles related to debt. I highly recommend the book, The Web of Debt, and her website by the same name. And you can also review all of the shows in this series at the archives, www.kruufm.com, under Life and Debt, specifically Life and Debt Web. So let's continue with a review of where we ended up in the last show. We're on Chapter 10, The Great Humbug, The Gold Standard and the Straw Man of Inflation. Humbug is a word that isn't used much today, but in the Gilded Age, it was a popular term for describing frauds, shams, and con artists. Vernon Parrington, a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian in the 1920s, used it to describe the arguments of the bankers to silence the farmers who were trying to reform the banker-controlled money system in the 1890s. It was the farmers who particularly felt the pinch of tight money when the bankers withheld their gold. Parrington wrote that the farmers pitted their homespun experience against the authority of the bankers and the teaching of the schools. In response to their clear-headed arguments, the bankers defended with a smokescreen of confusing rhetoric. He said denunciation took the place of exposition and hysteria of argument. And in this revel of demagoguery, the so-called educated classes, lawyers and editors and businessmen, were perhaps the most shameless purveyors of humbuggery. Stripped of all hypocrisy, the main issue was this. Should the control of currency issues with the delegated power of inflation and deflation lie in the hands of private citizens or with the elected representatives of the people? But throughout the years, when the subject was debated in every newspaper and on every stump, the real issue was rarely presented for consideration. The bankers did not dare to present it, for too much was at stake, and once it was clearly understood by the suspicious electorate, their case was lost. Hence, the strategy of the money group was to obscure the issue, an end they achieved by dwelling on the single point of inflation. And as you will hear me say many times during this discourse, we are hearing the exact same things today. Again, from the banks and their mouthpiece, the government, which in effect does what the bankers demand. The bankers meaning the Fed in the United States, the Federal Reserve. So let's look at the inflation issue. There's a theory called the quantity theory of money. The gold standard and the inflation argument that was used to justify it were based on the classical quantity theory of money. The foundation of classical monetary theory, it held that inflation is caused by too much money chasing too few goods. When demand, the money available to buy goods, increases faster than supply, goods and services, prices are forced up. Probably all of us abide by that theory. At least that's what we learned in school. If the government were allowed to simply issue all the greenback dollars it needed, the money supply would increase faster than goods and services, and price inflation would result. If paper money were tied to gold, a commodity in limited and fixed supply, the money supply would remain stable and price inflation would be avoided. Now, a corollary to that theory was the classical maxim that the government should balance its budget at all costs. If it ran short of money, it was supposed to borrow from the bankers rather than print the money it needed in order to keep from inflating the money supply. The argument was a straw man argument, one easily knocked down because it contained a logical fallacy. But the fallacy was not immediately obvious because the bankers were concealing their hand. The fallacy lay in the assumption that the money the government borrowed from the banks already existed and was merely being recycled. If the bankers themselves were creating the money they lent, the argument collapsed in a heap of straw. Let me repeat that. If the bankers themselves were creating the money they lent, the argument collapsed in a heap of straw. The money supply would obviously increase just as much from bank-created money as from government-created money. In either case, it was the money pulled out of an empty hat. Money created by the government, however, had the advantage that it would not plunge the taxpayers into debt, and it provided a permanent money supply, one not dependent on higher and higher levels of borrowing to stay afloat. Except from the banker's perspective, government-created money is much better. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now back to the quantity theory of money. The quantity theory of money actually contained another logical fallacy, which was pointed out later by British economist John Maynard Keynes. He said, adding money, demand, to the economy would drive up prices only if the supply side of the equation remained fixed. If new greenbacks were used to create new goods and services, supply would increase along with demand, and the prices would remain fixed. stable. So a simple example that was given is when a shoe salesman with many unsold shoes on his shelves suddenly got more customers, he did not raise his prices, he sold more shoes. If he ran out of shoes, he ordered more from the factory, which produced more. If he were to raise his prices, his customers would go to the shop down the street where shoes were still being sold at lower prices. Adding more money to the economy would inflate prices only when the producers ran out of the labor and materials needed to make more goods. Before that, supply and demand would increase together, leaving prices as they were before. This kind of theoretical revision helps explain such paradoxical data as the economic mystery of China. The Chinese have managed to keep the prices of their products low for thousands of years, although their money supply has continually been flooded with the world's gold and silver, and now the world's dollars, as those currencies have poured in to pay for China's cheap products. The Keynesian explanation is that prices have remained stable because the money has gone into producing more goods, increasing supply along with demand. Writers have noticed that a long-standing mystery for the economic historians lies in how so much gold and silver flowed into China for centuries for the purchase of Chinese goods, yet caused little inflation in China. Many of the Chinese manufactured goods remained much cheaper than other countries' manufactured goods until the early 1800s, despite the rapidly growing supply of silver sloshing around the Chinese economy. One theory is that Chinese output was expanding as fast as the precious metals supply. The same phenomenon has appeared today, as dollars inundating China have resulted in practically no increase in prices for most goods and services. By the year 2007, Chinese economists were complaining that consumer prices were rising, but this was primarily due to the rising international costs of fuel and food, and to the fact that the yuan was tightly pegged to the US dollar, that was rapidly becoming devalued in international markets. Now, price inflation from changes in exchange rates, as we'll see later, is a different thing from inflation due to an increase in the supply of money over goods and services. Now, back to the story. While the U.S. bankers were insisting that the government must borrow rather than print money that it needed, the residents of a small island state off the coast of England were quietly conducting a 200-year experiment that would show the bankers' inflation argument to be humbug. Guernsey is located among the British Channel Islands, about 75 miles south of Great Britain. In 1994, Dr. Bob Blaine, professor of sociology at Southern Illinois University, wrote of this remarkable island. In 1816, its seawalls were crumbling, its roads were muddy, and only 4.25 feet wide. Guernsey's debt was £19,000. The island's annual income was £3,000, of which £2,400 had to be used to pay interest on its debt. Not surprisingly, people were leaving Guernsey and there was little employment. Then the government created and loaned new interest-free state notes worth £6,000. Some £4,000 were used to start the repairs of the seawalls. In 1820, another £4,500 was issued, again interest-free. In 1821, another 10,000, 1824, 5,000, 1826, 20,000. By the year 1837, £50,000 had been issued interest-free for the primary use of projects like seawalls, roads, the marketplace, churches, and colleges. This sum more than doubled the island's money supply during this 13-year period, but there was no inflation. In the year 1914, as the British restricted the expansion of their money supply due to World War I, the people of Guernsey commenced to issue another £142,000 over the next 4 years and never looked back. By 1958, over £542,000 had been issued, all without inflation. The island of Guernsey has an income tax, but it is relatively low, a flat 20%, and it is simple and loophole free. It has no inheritance tax, no capital gains tax, and no federal debt. Commercial banks service private lenders, but the government itself never goes into debt. When it wants to create some public work or service, it just issues the money it needs to pay for the work. The Guernsey government has been issuing its own money supply for nearly two centuries. During that time, the money supply has mushroomed to about 25 times its original size, yet the economy has not been troubled by price inflation, and it has remained prosperous and stable. Many other countries have also successfully issued their own money, but Guernsey is one of the few to have stayed under the radar long enough to escape the covert attacks of an international banking cartel bent on monopolizing the money-making market. As we'll discuss later, governments that have dared to create their own money supply have generally wound up dealing with a presidential assassination, a coup, a boycott, a war, or a concerted assault on the national currency by international speculators. The American colonists operated successfully on their own sovereign money until British moneylenders leaned on Parliament to halt the practice, prompting the American Revolution, as we discussed earlier. England had a thriving economy that operated on the sovereign money of the king until Oliver Cromwell let the moneylenders inside the gates. After 1700, the right to create money was transferred to the Private Bank of England based on a fraudulent gold standard that allowed it to duplicate the gold in its vaults many times over in the form of paper banknotes. Today, governments are in the position of the disenfranchised king, having to borrow money created by the banks rather than issuing it themselves. In 1863, Eleazar Lord, a New York banker, called the gold standard itself a humbug. He wrote, "The so-called specie basis, or gold standard, whenever there is a foreign demand for coin, proves to be a mere fiction, a practical humbug, and whenever by an excess of imports, this pretended basis is exported to pay foreign debts, the banknotes are withdrawn from circulation or become worthless, the currency for the time is annihilated, prices fall, business is suspended, debts remain unpaid, panic and distress ensue, men in active business fail, bankruptcy, ruin, and disgrace reign." The requirement that paper banknotes be backed by a certain weight of gold bullion, Lord said, was a fiction. Banks did not have nearly enough gold to redeem all the paper money that was supposed to be based on it, and there was no real reason the nation's paper money had to be linked to gold at all. The gold standard just put America at the mercy of the foreign financiers who controlled the gold. When national imports exceeded exports, gold bullion left the country to pay the bill. And when gold stores shrank, the supply of paper money based on it shrank as well. So the real issue here, as Vernon Parrington pointed out, was not what money consisted of, but who created it. Whether the medium of exchange was gold or paper or numbers in a ledger, when it was lent into existence by private lenders and was owed back to them with interest, more money would always be owed back than was created in the first place, spiraling the economy into perpetual debt. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So now take that to heart. The issue is not what money consisted of, but who created it. A dollar borrowed at 6%, compounded annually, grows in 100 years to be a debt of $339. That is true whether the money takes the form of gold or paper or accounting entries, and nowadays on a computer screen. The banks lend the dollar into existence, but not the additional $338 needed to pay the loan off, forcing the public to go further and further into debt in search of the ephemeral interest due on their money built on debt. Merchants continually have to raise their prices to try to cover this interest tab, producing perpetual price inflation. Like the Tin Woodman, whose axe was enchanted by the witch to chop off parts of his own body in The Wizard of Oz, the more people work, the less they seem to have left for themselves. They cannot keep up because their money keeps shrinking, as sellers keep raising their prices in a futile attempt to pay off loans that are collectively impossible to repay. If the scarecrow in search of a brain represented the unschooled farmers matching wits with the bankers, the Tin Woodman, who had chopped out his own heart, reflected the plight of the working man exploited by the corporation, which was increasingly replacing the small family business competing in a free market. In 1886, corporations were given the rights and privileges of individuals, although they lacked the morality and the conscience of live human beings. Their sole motive, because they did not have a soul, was profit, the sort of single-minded devotion to self-interest that in a live human being would be considered pathological. Corporations are feudalistic organizations designed in the structure of a pyramid, with an elite group at the top manipulating masses of workers below. Workers are kept marching in lockstep, passing orders down from above, out of fear of losing their jobs, their homes, and their benefits if they get out of line. At the top of the pyramid is a small group of controllers who alone know what is really going on. Critics have noted that the pyramid with an overseeing eye at the top is also the symbol of the Federal Reserve note, the privately issued currency that became the national monetary unit in 1913. The popular grassroots movements that produced the Greenback and the populist parties in the 1890s represented the interests of the common man over these corporate and financial oppressors. Populism today tends to be associated with the political left, but the word comes from the Latin word simply for people. In the 19th century, it stood for the government of the people, by the people, for the people, proclaimed by Abraham Lincoln. According to Wikipedia, populism on the whole does not have a strong political identity as either a left-wing or right-wing movement. Populism has taken left-wing, right-wing, and even centrist forms. In recent years, conservative United States politicians have begun adopting populist rhetoric, for example, promising to get big government off your backs. That's what Wikipedia says. Although the oppressor today is seen to be big government, what the 19th century populists were trying to get off their backs was a darker, more malevolent force. They still believed that the principles set forth in the Constitution could be achieved through a democratic government of the people. They saw their antagonists rather as the private money power and the corporations it had spawned, which were threatening to take over the government unless the people intervened. Abraham Lincoln was quoted as saying, "I see in the future a crisis approaching that unnerves me and causes me to tremble for the safety of my country. Corporations have been enthroned. An era of corruption in high places will follow, and the money power of the country will endeavor to prolong its reign by working upon the prejudices of the people until the wealth is aggregated in the hands of a few and the republic is destroyed. Now, there's a debate as to whether Abraham Lincoln actually said this, because as with many famous quotations, its authorship is disputed. But whoever said it, the insight was prophetic, and it was said 150 years ago. In January 2007, in an article called Who Rules America, Professor James Petrus wrote, "Today it is said 2% of the households own 80% of the world's assets. Within this small elite, a fraction embedded in financial capital owns and controls the bulk of the world's assets and organizes and facilitates further concentration of conglomerates." Professor Petrus observed, quote, "Within the financial ruling class, political leaders come from the public and private equity banks, namely Wall Street, especially Goldman Sachs, Blackstone, and Carlyle Group, and others. They organize and fund both major parties and their electoral campaigns. They pressure, negotiate, and draw up the most comprehensive and favorable legislation on global strategies, liberalization and deregulation, and sectoral policies. They pressure the government to bail out bankrupt and failed speculative firms and to balance the budget by lowering social expenditures instead of raising taxes on speculative windfall profits. These private equity banks are involved in every sector of the economy, in every region of the world economy, and increasingly speculate in the conglomerates which are acquired. Much of the investment funds now in the hands of the U.S. investment banks, hedge funds, and other sectors of the financial ruling class originated in profits extracted from workers in the manufacturing and service sector." In short, it seems that the Tin Man has indeed been stripped of his heart and soul by the Witch of the East, the Wall Street bankers, just as Lincoln, the greenbackers, and the populists foresaw. So now we'll move ahead to the next concept, which is how the bankers actually capture the money machine. We're doing a lot of parallels in this show with The Wizard of Oz, particularly the book rather than the movie. And when the council with the Munchkins came up in The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, the Wicked Witch of the East held the Munchkins in bondage for many years, making them slave for her night and day. And remember, I said that the Wicked Witch of the East is Wall Street. The first thing that needs to be discussed is No Place Like Home, fighting for the family farm in the late 1800s, which precipitated actually the writing of The Wizard of Oz. And if you recall, Dorothy actually said to the Scarecrow, which represents the farmers, in The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, she said, "No matter how dreary and gray our homes are, we people of flesh and blood would rather live there than in any other country, be it ever so beautiful. There is no place like home." So we're going to explore why people might wonder why Dorothy, who could have stayed and played in the Technicolor Wonderland of Oz, was so eager to get home to her dreary Kansas farm. So come on back and listen next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.